Larry Saunders, registration number 21194, appearing on behalf of Ms. Kiekhaver, the appellant. And the main issue in this case is one of statutory construction. How do we interpret Section 841301? And the claimant's position is based on several arguments. First of all, we believe that the panel's interpretation is an unfair one. And any time you have an unfair interpretation of a statute, that should give somebody pause as to whether the statute is in fact interpreted correctly, because statutes are to be interpreted in such a manner that they can yield a fair result. Second of all, the panel's interpretation creates a contradiction within the statute, and I believe it is irrational by its very nature. And thirdly, the petitioner is offering a rational interpretation of the statute, and one of the key principles of statutory construction in workers' compensation cases is that the law is to be interpreted liberally in favor of claimants, so that if the claimant does have a rational interpretation, that's the one that governs, even if the other side can come up with a rational interpretation too. And in this case, I don't believe there is another rational interpretation. First of all, with respect to the fairness aspect of this interpretation, the panel is literally saying that the claimant has to prove in the first instance that they actually have a permanent disability before they can recover any benefits in the work comp. And that includes medical benefits, temporary disability benefits. And the example that I used in my brief was that means a female employee could actually be raped, and as long as she cooperates with the rapist, she doesn't have a physical injury. So she's required to complete these requirements. And at the very next day, she can't go into work, and I don't think anybody really expect her to be able to go into work. Under those circumstances, her employer can deny her claim.
Isn't this heightened burden exactly what our courts have said does exist in these mental cases for many, many years now? So if your argument is it's unfair, isn't that an argument that at least we're an intermediate appellate court, so we've got all these cases out there. Mm-hmm. Isn't that an argument that you should be making to the legislature?
No, I don't believe so. I believe it is a principle of statutory construction. I don't believe any of the courts have ever addressed this issue before, that many of the cases on this issue actually did deal with permanent disability benefits, or there was simply an assumption that this statute applies in the first instance. I think if you read through the statute, it clearly doesn't apply. But I could jump ahead and point out the contradictions that are inherent in the panel's interpretation. And I think when you have a contradictory interpretation of the statute, it cannot stand. And basically, if you look at subsection 2A, it does say that in order to have a mental impairment, it is defined as it has to be permanent and it has to be a disability. And disability in work comp means that you can't do your functions of your job, and it has to be permanent. That can only be determined when you've reached maximum medical improvement. Because until you're done treating and you're as good as you're going to get, you cannot determine whether you have a permanent disability. That means that you cannot get temporary disability benefits under work comp. That would be compensation for wage loss benefits, because those benefits can only be paid out before you reach maximum medical improvement. And yet, if you look down subsection 2B, it says that the award for permanent partial disability benefits is normally limited to 12 weeks, and that's inclusive of any previously paid out temporary disability benefits. So 2B implies that you can indeed have temporary disability benefits for a mental impairment claim without satisfying subsection 2A, because if you have to satisfy subsection 2A, you would never have temporary disability benefits. And that's one contradiction. And then if you go down to subsection B, it defines mental impairment. It says it can be a temporary disability or a permanent disability. Well, how do you reconcile that with the definition in 2A, which requires permanency? You've already got a contradiction. Subsection D also goes on to say, or it could just require psychological treatment, in which case subsection D actually defines mental impairment as not requiring anything permanent or anything disabling, just the need for medical treatment. So to go with the panel's interpretation, I don't see how you can possibly say that you have an interpretation that is rationally consistent, whereas the claimant's is rationally consistent. And it the interpretation is 2A applies to the request for permanent partial disability benefits. So it's triggered when the claimant's actually making a claim that I'm permanently disabled because of what's happened. And fine, maybe there's some suspicions because you can't, like, take an x-ray or do an MRI scan and determine a permanent injury like you can in a physical case. So there's this heightened burden, and that makes sense. And that would make sense also that there's a limitation with respect to permanent disability benefits, that it's limited to the 12 weeks limitation. And then with respect to just a claimant is bringing a claim in the first instance, just trying to get medical benefits, which was all that was being requested in this case, there is no heightened scrutiny because we can't determine if somebody's at permanent, has a permanent disability until they're done treating.
Is there anything in the legislative history from 1999 that would support this view?
I don't have anything in particular I can give the court. I don't have anything particular one way or the other. I do know that the way the statute is written, I don't know how you can interpret it otherwise. Because what you do with subsection D and what you do with subsection 2B.
Sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Saunders, but let me ask you this question. Let me back up just a little bit, and you're talking about 2A. The very first sentence of 2A says a claim of mental impairment must be proven by evidence supported by the testimony of a licensed physician or psychologist. It's my understanding from the record in this case that Ms. Kiekhafer did not present any testimony from a licensed physician or psychologist to support her claim of mental impairment. So why do we go any further than that?
Well, first of all, the courts have said it doesn't have to be live testimony. It can be records. And second of all, what I'm stating is that this section only...
Well, was there something other than live testimony from a psychologist or a licensed physician?
Well, we did submit medical records that were admitted as exhibits, and the courts have held that you don't actually have to have live testimony to even satisfy that statutory section. It can be just documentary evidence from a medical report.
But wasn't there a finding that there was no such evidence, either live or documentary, from a licensed professional here?
That's true. But that's why I'm saying I think the statute is incorrectly applied, because all we requested was medical treatment. We did not request permanent partial disability benefits. And this subsection only applies to claims that are for permanent disability benefits by its very nature. Otherwise, again, how do you reconcile the definition of mental impairment in 2B and 2D? Because 2D doesn't mention anything about having to have a permanent disability or even a disability of any kind. So right there you have a conflict. If you're saying 2A governs in the first instance, you have this irreconcilable conflict between 2A and 2D. And also, how do you explain in 2B that a claimant can in fact have temporary disability benefits without having to satisfy, if they have to satisfy 2A in the first instance? Because if you have a permanent impairment, you have to be at maximum medical improvement and you're not eligible for temporary disability benefits. So our argument is that an incorrect legal standard was applied. And I'll concede at the outset, if
this doesn't say you have to have a permanent impairment, it says you have to have a permanent disability,
which is actually worse than a permanent impairment, because a permanent impairment is just an alteration in a person's ability to function, whereas a permanent disability means that alteration is so devastating that it actually affects their ability to do their job. So you can't have a permanent impairment without having a permanent disability, but you cannot have a permanent disability without having a permanent impairment. And if you cannot have a permanent disability without having a permanent impairment, you cannot have a permanent disability until you reach maximum medical improvement, which would preclude an award of temporary disability benefits. So how can there be language in 2B saying that the 12-week limitation is inclusive of any temporary disability benefits award? And how do you explain subsection D that doesn't say anything with respect to the need for a disability of any kind, much less it being a permanent one? And so if you go with the panel's interpretation, then I think you're, not only is it unfair, but I don't see how it's statutorily sensible to come up with that interpretation. And nobody's explained this. I mean, there's not a single case out there that's ever explained how you can reconcile the panel's interpretation of 2A and say that that governs in the first instance on a mental, a claim for mental impairment, and how you can reconcile that interpretation with the statutory language in subsection 2B and subsection 2D. The panel hasn't done it in this case. The administrative law judge hasn't done it in this case. Nobody has.
What are the limitations on your interpretation? I mean, if we accept your interpretation, does it just eviscerate this rule that we've had forever on mental claims, that you have to prove those by evidence from a licensed professional? I don't understand what the limitation is.
It would be limited just to, I apologize if I didn't make myself clear. It would just be limited to the claim for permanency. So in the first instance, the claimant could come forward and say, look, I haven't had a chance to get medical treatment yet. And so I can't come here, even though I'm devastated. There's just been a horrible thing that's happened at work. I can't go to work. I can't support myself. I need treatment. But I still get, if I can show causally that my condition is related to what happened at work and it would otherwise be compensable, then I'm at least entitled to medical treatment and even temporary disability benefits. Then, after I reach maximum medical improvement, if I want to make the further claim that I have suffered a permanent disability, then I have the heightened requirement that is found in 2A, that I have to meet that proof requirement. And if you have that interpretation, then everything falls into place and makes sense, and it also gives you a fair result. And you can read all the cases, and there's no explanation of any kind in any of the case law that explains how you get around the contradiction between 2A and 2B and 2D if you go with the current interpretation that the panel is using. And there just isn't. And so I think right here we have not just any rational interpretation of the statute, but I think the only one that's been put forth to date. And since the law is supposed to favor claimants with respect to workers' compensation cases, then I think the petitioner should prevail in this case. And I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, if I may.
Got about 2 minutes and 40 seconds.
Right, thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors. Kelly Krugel, registration number 36571, representing the appellees in this matter. The claim that was brought before Judge Stuber and then brought to the Industrial Claim Appeals Office has been articulated as one purely arising out of a claim for mental impairment. Ms. Keekaper alleged no physical injury whatsoever as a part of her workers' compensation claim. Her claim arose purely as one based on mental disease or distress. At the outset of the hearing, the respondents, appellees, noted that they were proceeding under a direct theory that she had not met or would not meet the burdens under 841-301-2A. No objection at that point was raised by Mr. Saunders that we were proceeding under an incorrect statute or that that statute did not apply to address that argument with Judge Stuber at the court level. As Your Honors have articulated, it has long been a standing in the Colorado Workers' Compensation Courts, the Industrial Claim Appeals Panel, the Court of Appeals, as well as the Colorado Supreme Court, that claims brought on behalf of mental impairment, known as mental claims, where you're involving a mental injury only and no physical component, have been subject to the heightened burden of proof articulated in 841-301-2A. As Your Honors also noted, in 1999, there was a statutory amendment that was invoked by the General Assembly, which, based on the legislative intent stated at that point in time, was intended to make it more difficult to bring these types of mental-only claims. The legislature at that point in time articulated that because these types of claims did not have direct physical proof, you couldn't see the bruises, you couldn't tell from an MRI that there had been an actual injury, that something needed to be there in order to evoke a better checks and balances system on these mental-only claims. Thus, the legislature brought in what is now 841-301-2A and utilized that as the heightened burden of proof by which a person must establish a compensable claim for mental impairment.
1999, they also added section 2A.5, which said that for purposes of this subsection 2, mental impairment also includes a disability arising from an accidental physical injury that leads to a recognized permanent psychological disability. So there's really no difference, is there, between a mental and mental physical?
The court has applied a difference, Your Honor, that in cases that have discussed whether this heightened burden of proof actually needs to apply in order to obtain medical benefits, the court has declined to apply the heightened burden of proof under 841-301-2A in an instance where, say, the individual had a compensable knee claim, but then said, I am now suffering depression because of my inability to go back to work. The courts have held that that person who has a physical injury, there's a subset of physical mental claims, doesn't need to actually meet this extra special burden to establish and receive medical benefits for depression that may arise out of a physical injury. So there has been a distinction very clearly drawn by the courts, which put mental claims, which is what we're talking about today, in a different box. But I do recognize what Your Honor says, that you could have a mental impairment arising from a physical injury, or you can have a mental impairment resulting in physical disability from a purely psychological external stimuli, which is the case of the present claim. The interpretation offered by Mr. Saunders and by the claimant in this matter is a very strained, forced reading that will essentially eviscerate the heightened burden of proof that has been applicable for mental-only claims. If you read it as he is advocating, first off, there is no other section of the Workers' Compensation Act under which Ms. Kiekhofer's claim would be compensable. She hasn't suffered any physical injury. So to put it out there that she simply has to go under a straight causation standard, there's no other area of the Workers' Compensation Act where she could prove to establish a compensable injury. As the court in Mobley noted, what the statute does is Section 841-301 lays out the conditions of recovery for all workers' compensation claims, and then it subjects mental impairment claims to special evidentiary requirements. And those special evidentiary requirements are what we've already been talking about today, namely being that you have to have testimony of a licensed physician or psychologist to establish that the worker who suffered a traumatic event, and then you also have to show that that traumatic event was outside the course of that worker's ordinary experience.
And isn't there another requirement that it has to be permanent, right, under 2A? So if someone has a temporary mental disability, your position is they're simply not covered by the Workers' Compensation Act?
Your Honor, I think that potentially, yes. However, I would note that there is a difference between a recognized permanent disability and a recognized permanent impairment. That permanent disability and impairment don't mean the same thing. I would advance that the legislature, in using the term permanent disability, wanted something to be there beyond I have a temporary aggravation of some sort of nebulous mental condition. They wanted it to be a recognized permanent condition.
But what if, for example, someone's working in a factory and one of their closest friends, a coworker, is right before their eyes is a horrible injury. Maybe they're just a terrible injury. It's very traumatic for that person. And the doctor says, well, that's a temporary thing that with proper treatment will be taken care of. They would not be entitled to any benefits under the Workers' Compensation Act. Is that right?
Under the recognized permanent disability, the first clause, potentially no, Your Honor. Now, I would say that it is a question for the court, being the presiding administrative law judge, whether that is in fact an actual permanent disability or a transient disability.
How do you square that then with the section 2D, which talks about temporarily and permanently disabled?
Because, Your Honor, you can establish, as I further articulated in my brief, that you have a permanent disability that is different from a permanent impairment. Temporary disability benefits and permanent impairment benefits are calculable measures under the Workers' Compensation Act. Those are different from saying somebody could have a permanent disability and be entitled to neither of those things. So to differentiate from the statute to say that, let me back up. you could establish, you're not bound to prevent yourself from seeking a determination that you have a compensable claim under the mental impairment statute and requesting that an order for temporary disability benefits under that statute be made. You can utilize the burdens of proof that have been set forth by the court to establish that you have a permanent disability. That is not something that has to wait until maximum medical improvement, as Mr. Saunders argued, because permanent impairment and permanent disability are two different things.
And then section two, maybe I don't understand, so let me see if I do. Section 2A talks about having a permanent disability arising from accidental injury, which is
correct, Your Honor.
Which is subject to the requirement of having an expert testimony. 2D uses this, doesn't talk about impairment, it talks about temporarily or permanently disabled.
Correct, Your Honor.
And I'm not clear what, how that can work. Why would we get into temporary if in order to be qualified for benefits you have to have a doctor or a physician explain that you are permanently disabled?
And you would never get to that section, Your Honor, without first establishing the threshold requirements for compensability, which are what is set forth in 841-301-2A. So the remainder of the sections,
which requires a permanent disability.
It does require, that's what the statute says, Your Honor.
Yeah, so having a temporary disability, you would not be covered, correct?
Potentially not, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
But that is what the statute says, and the court is bound by the legislative construction of what it is given. There is no ambiguity in the statute. What is required in order to establish a claim for mental impairment is meeting the burden of proof set forth under the statute. That is what the court has long held. Multiple courts, from the Mobley to the Esser matter, have all consistently held that in order to establish a compensable claim under the Workers' Compensation Act for mental impairment, you must meet that threshold burden. I acknowledge what Your Honor is saying, that it is potentially a difficult situation for a person when they might not be able to establish that they have a permanent disability. But that is what the legislature intended to do. They intended to place a heightened, more difficult burden of proof on individuals who are seeking claims for mental only. Mr. Saunders brought up a issue of a rape victim. That's actually been addressed by the courts previously of what would happen under those specific circumstances, acknowledging that rape is actually a physical injury in and of itself. So that is not a concern that would be appropriately brought under this particular statute. Furthermore,
because a rape is accidental.
Well, a rape itself is a physical act, and the court has been very clear in looking at mental only. It physically is a mental stimulus only, and I don't think anyone would deem to say that a rape or even an attempted rape would not involve some physical contact or physical stimuli. Furthermore, the basis of Judge Stuber's original order was not even that Ms. Kiekefer failed to show that she had a permanent disability. That section was never even discussed by Judge Stuber. What Judge Stuber found is that she had failed to present testimony as required by the statute in support of her claim, and then he found that even if she had presented such testimony, she still had not sustained her burden of proof to establish a compensable injury. Now, while it is absolutely true that Judge Stuber applied 841-301-2A in looking at the heightened burden of proof, that is what the Industrial Claim Appeals Panel also upheld, that that is the appropriate statute by which a claim for mental impairment is to be judged. As I've already articulated, Your Honor, I don't feel that the statute itself is ambiguous. I believe it is very clear in what it meant. If you do want to entertain an argument that the statute is ambiguous, the potential conflict between the discussion of temporary disability benefits and permanent disability benefits, that if the statute is ambiguous, then you turn to the rules of statutory construction. Contrary to what Mr. Saunders advocated, there is no mandate that if there are ambiguities, they must be interpreted in favor of the injured worker. What the Sagala case, which he cited for that proposition, actually says is that the act is intended to be remedial and beneficial in purpose and should be interpreted to give its beneficial nature. Nothing in that case or in any other mandates under the Workers' Compensation Act requires that the court defer to an interpretation that favored the injured worker, and certainly not an interpretation that would substantially harm the rights of the insurers or the employers in this matter. In fact, furthermore, the Workers' Compensation Act itself already says that facts of the cases are not to be skewed in favor of either side under 843.201. If the interpretation as advanced by Mr. Saunders is given, what you will have is a situation where an individual can say, I have a claim for mental impairment with no physical injury, but I only want medical benefits and potentially I only want temporary disability benefits right now. So that would be subject to a lesser burden of proof under what statute in the Workers' Compensation Act would that claim even fall under. But going under a lesser burden of proof for that particular case, you go before an administrative law judge and you have a determination made under that lesser burden of proof. Then that person treats, receives medical benefits at the cost of the employer and the insurer, potentially receives temporary disability benefits at the cost of the employer or the insurer. I will note, Your Honor, that the 12-week limitation on temporary disability benefits cannot be utilized to automatically cut those benefits off when the 12 weeks has expired based on the existing case law, that until the person reaches maximum medical improvement, once temporary disability benefits are ordered, those benefits continue. Then that individual reaches maximum medical improvement, undisputably now, if they're alleging permanent impairment, it falls under 2A. Is the case to be relitigated entirely anew based on the heightened burden of proof? That puts everyone in a very, very precarious position because you're going to have instances where the injured workers are pushing to get a case into the court before they've reached maximum medical improvement, so potentially the lower standard applies. It may put a situation where the insurance carrier is treating the case differently because they want to have the actual appropriate heightened burden of proof apply to the compensability of the claim. You can't have, under a reasonable statutory interpretation, two completely different burdens of proof applying to the same injury allegation. That does not mesh at all with the intent of the Workers' Compensation Act, with the plain language of the statute, or with the stated intent of the General Assembly when it provided the amendments in 1999, or the intent of the legislature prior to that, which has uniformly always been that mental impairment claims should be difficult to prove. I would respectfully ask Your Honors to uphold the interpretation of the Master Claim Appeals Panel in this matter and uphold the interpretations applying the statute to claims for mental impairment that have been previously held by the courts. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Saunders, we've got about 2 minutes and 40 seconds.
All right, thank you. Judge Miller, you did ask opposing counsel, how do you reconcile the different statutory subsections? And her answer to you was, you ignore subsection D, that the language in subsection D is absolutely meaningless. It's there for no reason. And I submit to you that the law is very clear that you do not interpret statutes so that statutory language serves no purpose. And that's what she just did.
And so how do you respond to her point that if you accept your construction of this section, then what section would the claim be filed under? Is there
really very easy to answer. It falls under the normal headings of subsection 841.301, subsection 1, A through C, and also subsection D. That subsection D actually does have meaning under my interpretation, that it's not just meaningless words. And so by limiting subsection 2A just to permanency, everything falls into place. And you can read all the case law, you can read all the interpretations that have been given under this case by the Industrial Claims Appeals Office, as well as opposing counsel, and they cannot give you an interpretation of this statute that gives sense to all of its provisions.
Counsel, I was just kind of briefly looking through your brief on appeal. I don't see that subsection D is even cited. So have you made this argument either to us or to the panel or to the ALJ? Because that subsection is not cited in your briefs.
No, you're right. And I didn't specifically cite that. I did point out the contradiction between 2A and 2B, and that 2A can only apply to permanency, because otherwise you have a contradiction with 2B giving temporary disability benefits. And really, I was looking at D, and I couldn't figure out how in the world does it make sense until yesterday, when I thought it actually, that is actually the statutory subsection that would apply in the case of a claimant coming forward and asking just for medical benefits. So I've always known there was a contradiction, but I couldn't figure out exactly how to explain it. But it is consistent with, I'm not changing anything about how I'm saying 2A should be interpreted. That is limited to permanent partial disability benefits, and it actually all fits together, makes sense under my construction. And certainly there's no, the panel and opposing counsel have not explained how you get the 2B, the temporary disability benefits, because you cannot get temporary disability benefits if you've established a permanent injury. It just can't happen. Once you establish permanency, you get permanent partial disability benefits, and you don't get temporary disability benefits. So you have two interpretations. Only one addresses every statutory provision. The other does not.
Thank you, counsel. Your time. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. Case will stand submitted. We'll issue an opinion in due course.